The topic for this evening, I don't even know how to give it a label. The topic for this evening is different. I had some discussion with Padmanabh about hear about it. There are lots of things we thought you all would like to hear about. But something that he hears a lot about from you is the economy.
This concern,
that concern, this anxiety, that anxiety,
this problem, that problem.
So we'll think a little bit about the economy.
And after I speak a little bit, I'm hoping we'll have an interactive session, like lively question-answer time. So we'll start what may appear to be a little theoretical, but it's relevant and relatable and very practical. For the past about a year, I've personally become more aware and interested in and concerned about not just the need to like pump up the economy again, but the need to reconsider altogether what does successful or a prosperous economy mean. And so I made a presentation at colleges from coast to coast and at devotee gatherings and at Microsoft and Intel and Lucent and those kind of places, AT&T, on the topic of spiritual economics. So I'm not going to do that this evening. I'll just tell you what that little presentation was about. We okay? The first part is a definition. What's economics? Am I not okay? Closer to the mic. There's a common definition of economics. Call it consumer economics or something like that. Production and consumption. Economics is economic growth or economic health is lots of production and lots of consumption of consumer goods. That's a healthy economy. Spiritual economics says where the well-being of the individual soul is the driving force and determining factor of healthy economics. So, where did that idea come from? Modern times, they didn't read the Vedas, that came from economists that have studied the growth of the economy to see how well are we doing and how can we do better. That's what economists are supposed to do. And their studies found quality of life is becoming spoiled. People are becoming more unhappy. Interpersonal dealings are becoming more oppressive, harsh, and causes of war, in fact, over trying to make the economy better between this group and that group of people, interpersonal. The environment is being literally destroyed and gobbled up. So it's a formula that's not working. Consumer economics, it's not just right now people are losing jobs. Consumer economics is not working as it was supposed to work. So, that's about 40 minutes worth in 3 minutes. You know, with researchers, not just, Harvard University researchers and Princeton University researchers and, very prestigious people that have researched the subject, economists, over decades, and their careers are at stake by producing factual information, not hyperbolic stuff. So, what to do? The presentation that I made, I ran out of time. I said, well, green economics is what a lot of people are turning to. And there's problems with green economics, and one of them is it's good, but it's not enough. And it also has its problems, its byproduct problems, in a number of ways, without detailing it. And so my presentation has been, therefore, the economists are saying spiritual economics. That's their title. There's a book, Towards Spiritual Economics. It's a collection of essays of economists who have, this is their field, and it's their term, spiritual economics. So what is spiritual economics? Read Srimad Bhagavatam, and that's spiritual economics. Yenatma supersedati, Vasudeva Bhagavati, Bhakti Yoga Prayojyatah, Janyati Asho Vairagyam, Jnanam Shayatahaitakam, Savai Pungsung Paro Dharmo, Yato Bhakti Radhoksajay, Ahoitakya Pratyata, Yayatma supersedati. That's spiritual economics. What is the objective? Atma supersedati. Not just goods and services, more, but atma supersedati. And how do you, that's the objective of spiritual economics. And so there's a natural, there are terms that are buzzwords in the world and buzzwords in where funding is being granted these days and people in their postdoc research positions and in the commercial world are working on sustainable energy supply and so many other kinds of nice words connected with sustainability. So to help make this topic more real, I'm going to walk you through very quickly one presentation. This is normally goes with a half hour talk with a Nobel Prize winner, not a candidate, but a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. In other words, he's not a doomsday fellow. It's a Nobel Prize winning chemist from SMU who his presentation is on, we have a very serious problem here. This is his PowerPoint, and I acquired it, and just now taking you through it. This is the pie chart of where we get, what are the global problems of the world today? We certainly hear a lot about terrorism. We certainly hear a lot about disease and medical problems, and just disasters from natural calamities and air pollution and poverty and so on. Somewhere in there is education. the small slice of the pie that the world considers to be a problem. But this is, the energy problem is a huge problem, and you can pay half attention and you'll be alarmed. If you pay full attention, you'll be very alarmed. The current use of the world today of energy is 14.4 terawatts of energy. Trillion watts of energy, or that's the equal of 220 million barrels of oil per day. Of course, what do we know about, what does that represent? How many million barrels of oil? What's that like? Well, there's a website that tells all about it. There's a movie that tells all about it. It's called, it's a pun. You've heard of A Rude Awakening? This is called A Crude, as in crude oil. A Crude Awakening. And this is Rick Smalley, Nobel laureate, saying if you stack Coke cans, each filled to the top with oil, they'll go 12 million kilometers or 7.5 million miles high. That's 30 times to the moon and back again, or 15 times to the moon and back again. That's each day. Each day. The current global use of energy percentage-wise is largely oil. Of all those, of all the energy that the Earth is using each day or each year or whatever quantum you want to go by, huge amount of coal, huge amount of coal, huge amount of gas, all three of those top running items are non-renewable. And the prediction of when they'll run out is in a few years. At the rate that we're presently burning these fuels and the known supplies. So here's Rick Smalley's chart. He's using as his source a fellow professor at NYU. Currently, or at least in 2005, we were using, this is in terawatts again, 7 terawatts of power. There's terawatts of power. And 7 billion people, estimating the population to grow to 10 billion people by 2050, they were using 14 terawatts of power. And with the increase of the world population, not allowing for the fact that India and China are becoming more wealthy and are using increasing amounts of energy, not allowing for that, just allowing for the population growth, there's the prediction of the amount of terawatts that are going to be needed. So how do you get from what we presently have to what we're going to need in 2050? That's not my picture. That's Rick Smalley's picture. Gee, there's a big gap. How do we close the gap? I don't know. Maybe it's oil. I'm going to play a trailer from A Crude Awakening. And I watched the whole movie while I was taking prasadam a couple of times. And from the year 1950, when the economy of the U.S. just like took off like anything, Texas was the Saudi Arabia of the world. And Texas was getting really rich because of the production of oil. But Texas ran dry. And then they found oil places in other parts of the world, certain places in Eastern Europe, certain places in Venezuela, certain places off the coast of Alaska. And the movie shows oil. And now it shows what it's like today. It's just refuse. There's no more oil. So it's a very... I'll just play the trailer.
Oil is our God. I don't care if somebody says they worship Jesus, Buddha, Allah, whoever. They actually worship petroleum.
It's all non-renewable, and it's probably the most invaluable raw natural resource we've ever discovered.
We're moving from an era of cheap, abundant energy to an era of scarce, hard-to-get, expensive energy. Oil is a magnet for war. Oil starts wars.
The demand is so huge, there is nothing that we can imagine to replace oil in those quantities.
Not one in a hundred of the people in our country have any inkling of the potential problem that we're facing.
So we enter an entirely new world of quite unbelievable dimensions, and yet it's only a few years away.
About a half an hour video. It's downloadable. You can go to Google Uncrude Awakening. It'll take you to the website. You can watch the thing. And it's very disturbing.
But it's something that we should, not to be not disturbed, we should know what is about to happen. World. So,
to replace the energy, one of the things in that documentary says that one barrel of oil produces so much energy that it's been calculated, it's equivalent to some number of men, like 100 men working for some period, a month or something like that. One barrel of oil, what energy it can be produced. So to make up for that oil that's soon to disappear within a few years, whatever number it is, 3, 5, some number of years, it's gone. So this is Rick Smalley, not some little guy, saying each nuclear power plant can generate 1/1000th of a terawatt, and we need 10 terawatts just to take care of what we're doing now. So if for the next 42 years every day there was a nuclear power plant that opened somewhere in the world, that would have the capacity of increasing the nuclear energy by double of what we're presently getting. That means 15,330 new nuclear power plants worldwide Is that going to happen? No way it's going to happen. One each day for the next 42 years. It's not going to happen. If it did happen, it would just equal taking care of the population's growth, not allowing for any increase in China and India. And we know certainly China and India are going to be demanding more energy. Not just because a number of you are from India. It's just the wealth of India is growing and the demand to imitate the style of life of the West is growing. So it's not going to happen. So Rick Smalley's view is we need to turn to solar energy. Why is that? Because every day the sun hitting the planet Earth represents 165,000 terawatts. So to have solar energy that can produce moving from 15 up to 45 terawatts per year for the Earth, it would take solar panels that cover the entire North Island of New Zealand. Is that going to happen? Or the entire surface of Cuba? Is that going to happen? Or the entire landmass of Iceland? Is that going to happen? He's hoping that there'll be an increase of solar power. Of course, it's also expensive. And this is the current picture again of percentages of the energy that's being produced in the world today, oil, coal, and gas being non-renewable sources. He's hoping, he calls it his wish list, that by 2050 it'll reverse and solar primarily, but wind and geothermal energy will replace that disproportionately. Here's another chart. He's hoping that more people will become scholars, PhDs, and do research like he was doing to help address the world's problem of needs for renewable energy sources. He's showing here that the Asian population has produced more and more PhDs per year, U.S. citizens about the same, a little less, going out into the future. So he's making an appeal that PhDs researching this energy problem are required. Be a scientist, save the world. This is his presentation. So the problem itself is very grave and serious. Very quickly, because I'm not attempting this evening to give you a logical step-by-step presentation as I would at a university, because it's a different audience and I want to go with it in a different place with this presentation, but just to give you some samples of research that's out there. So if you're worried about the instability of your job and having to spend not only time at the job but researching, networking, where you might find the next job if you lose your present job and all the stress that that produces for your life, there's a bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, you know, the direction that we're headed in. Here's what one article from The Economist said. Taking a look at water, you know, there's lots of research about it. Why should there be a problem with water? There's a problem with water. It's how people are using it. And there's a serious water shortage. There's a serious food shortage. I was just in St. Louis, and one of the persons that I met in St. Louis was a woman who just finished her PhD at Georgia Tech in bio something. She's now working for a company in St. Louis that's a national company, maybe international company, that's interested in providing sufficient food for the world's growing population. What one of the chief ways that they're tinkering with nature is genetic engineering of corn to produce more corn. But the more corn, is it really to feed the human population, the more corn? It's to provide more of the staple to feed the cattle so that people can continue to feed themselves on meat. That's what's... But, you know, the idea is the food problem. In New Vrindavan, in about 3 weekends from now, there's a festival of inspiration. I'm one of the speakers there, and I'm going to be speaking on this topic, the topic of sustainability. But I noticed on the list, I just got it about an hour ago before coming here, there are 4 speakers speaking on the same topic. There's a devotee coming from Hungary who's made a 4-part presentation before at our festival in Mayapur. And we gave him an hour and a half's time to speak to our GBC on the topic of sustainability, because there's a wave coming and thoughtful people have to be ahead, see the wave coming and be ahead of the wave, not just get the tsunami come and crash us. But there's a very serious thing that's happening. Imbalance in how we're conducting our lives on this planet. I'll play a very short video. A World Wildlife Foundation, they're not just interested in save the whales, they're interested in the well-being of the planet.
The Living Planet Report tells us that we are using the Earth's resources far too fast, faster than they can be replenished. The 3 indices in this report, the Living Planet Index, the ecological footprint, and the water footprint, all send that message, that our consumption is far outstripping the Earth's capacity to support it. The findings of this report should be alarming to any thoughtful person. It tells us that we're headed into deep trouble in terms of maintaining the planet's ability to support us.
In The Economist, there's a quote that says, one of the researchers, that it says, it's like being in a train and report coming to the conductor that there's a bridge over the ravine and the bridge is out. And the train is moving at 60 miles an hour and it's several hundred yards before the ravine. Now, what is the conductor supposed to do? Is the conductor supposed to put his foot on the accelerator pedal and see if he can jump over the ravine? Or is the conductor supposed to put his foot on the brake pedal and say, I think we need to stop this train before we hit that patch where the bridge is out? So what I haven't done is take you through the step by step by step. These are just little clips of things. But these aren't teenagers or radical people or revolutionaries or right-wingers or hysterical people. These are scholars who have spent, I mean, their profession is to study these situations, and we got a problem. Water problem, food problem. New York Times editorial saying, along with many other, there's pages of these references I could provide for you, but one of the major issues during our current president's administration is going to be to address the food problem, because it's not just a foreign problem. It's not some 1/5 of the world's population is in starvation condition. But food problem for Americans today, or people in, you know, prosperous Western first world economies, are going to face problems because, for a number of reasons, I don't need to list all the reasons. It's a very serious consideration. The New Yorker magazine had I'm distributing this at my presentation in New Vrindavan, like a 6-page article called The Last Bite. I think it's a pun or play on The Last Supper. The Last Bite of The Last Supper, where looking all around the world and persons who have studied this very carefully were in the world, the planet situation is in dire condition. A fair amount of it has to do with the lifestyle that people live. I mean, the simple appeal that if people were vegetarian, we could feed so much more of the world's population. But to get people to the point of being vegetarian because it will feed more of the world's population, that's like humanitarian. But humanitarian isn't changing people's views. Survival might change people's views. And wars over the supply of food might change people's views. But, you know, does it thoughtful individuals, like your good selves, who are already vegetarian, but need to be aware of, you know, what are the circumstances that the planet is facing, it adds a whole other dimension to the urgency of our mission, our message. The appeal is not just, gee, you should get some fire insurance, but the house is on fire, is the message. So, and if we're not, if you all, or if any one of us are not clear about that, there's plenty of material that can be, that I've come across in the past few months, very credible people. They're not the alarmist type people. We have a big problem. Big problem. Now, in light of having said those few things, now we'll get more directly to the topic this evening. So, in this presentation that I've made at the schools and these corporate places, where it goes to is consumer economics is fraught with problems. We need to hit the reset button and do something differently. One of the things that we need to do differently is some persons are saying green economics. But the respondents to green economics say, excuse me, but you forgot one of the core problems here is endless consumerism. It just becomes consume green. But how do you get people to consume less? Well, besides just there is less, so you have to consume less. But voluntarily consume less. It has to be on some other platform, a platform of what we know from Bhagavad Gita. Vishaya vinivartante niraharsha dehinam rasovarjam rasopyasya pramdrishtvandavartate. People who are attracted to sense enjoyment cannot give up sense enjoyment just by saying I should give up sense enjoyment, but by experience a higher taste, then it becomes possible. And what is that higher taste? Yenatma supracedati, whether the satisfaction is happening at the platform of the soul. Without spiritual, genuine, I'll say it again, genuine spiritual elevation, without genuine satisfaction on the platform of the soul, it will not, the lifestyle that people are living is not going to change. It'll just be another type of more instead of a different type of more. And more is never enough. It always has to be more. The mode of passion never finds that whenever that level of more is that you're satisfied, because it never takes place. There's no satisfaction other than on the platform of the soul. So the spiritual revolution, the spiritual change, is the requirement. So, two things that of the four presentations, like the one that I'm going to be making, the other three, they're going to point towards agriculture, economics, agroeconomics, but not agroeconomics in the term that it's agro-business, because that's fraught with problems too. It's the same greed that destroys the earth and harms the, you know, other than the person who is exploiting the land and the animals. But that's also that's harming the person and the persons who take the product of that kind of business. So sustainable agriculture is a direction that a lot of thoughtful people are turning their attention to. And I can tell you, from having spent the last month visiting several college campuses, that's the level of concern. In thoughtful young people in America today, there are two or three activist type of views. One is social change, social activism, they call it. Another is human rights, that of considering the freedoms of individuals, irrespective of their caste, color, creed, birth, or nationality, or gender. And another is this concern about sustainability, because they see the train is headed for a ravine and there's no bridge. Or another metaphor is the train is heading for a wall. It's going 60 miles an hour and it's a 10-foot brick wall with a big stone mountain behind it, and it's going to crash and we're all riding in the train. We have to do something. The way that the economists are in the accrued awakening are saying it is, if it's not our generation, it's our children. But for sure it will be our grandchildren. Where there's the lifestyle that we know today is gone. And we need to be making a plan for that future generation that's sustainable. Because what we're doing now is not sustainable. So what is sustainable is the Vedic culture of economics based upon agriculture, where we have the Vaishya is not just the businessman, but the Vaishya is Krishi, Goraksha, Vanijam, Vaishya Karma Svabhavajam. That's their occupation, like Krishna and Balaram. Balaram has the plow, Krishna has the flute. The flute is for calling the cows, and Balaram is for plowing the fields. Krishi Goraksha Vanijam Vaishya Karma Svabhavajam. Where the economy has that as its basis, not production and consumption, but you know what is produced naturally from the land. There's a growing, it's a pun, unintended. There's a rapidly increasing concern over learning the art of how the land can produce that which will sustain life on the planet, as opposed to the concerns for how the economy as we've known it can continue to take care of the demands of our expectations of standard of living, we call it. The other term is sense gratification that we're accustomed to. standard of living that we're accustomed to is not sustainable. The Earth planet today is 1.3 times the amount of resources the Earth planet has are being taken, which is not sustainable. And then it takes another the amount of time for that which is used to be regenerated and usable again. Not just recyclable green, but just like, you know, growing more trees again or something like that. It's a crash landing. We use in 1 year what it takes 10 years to renew. And that's the things that are renewable. And if the rest of the world, which is now imitating because we've trained them up to do so, if the rest of the world was enjoying standard of living on the level of the United States, we'd need five planets. We don't have five planets. We have only one. So even if, you know, aside from oil, all the other natural resources to maintain the standard of living. So those of you, it's not going to happen. We have to rethink the plan. So, aside from going back to agricultural economics, which most people, I would assume, in this room are not prepared to do, even to think seriously about it, although give it another 10 years and let's see what we're serious to think about or not. Even just what we can do now from a perspective of spiritual economics, taking the term, the very term that the economists themselves have used, that is, where the well-being of the soul is the driving force of the standard of strong economy. So each of you, myself included, each of us, can very carefully consider the things that, what are the things that we need? And think once, twice, thrice, even four and five times, if there's something, do I really need this something? And then is that something going to directly benefit the well-being of the soul, or the well-being of the soul of my family members? And if the answer is yes, then you spend, and otherwise you don't spend. One of the statistics from all of this is that in the United States, presently, of the consumer goods that are purchased in the United States today, within a period of 1 year, 99% is trashed. Not 50%, not 70%, 99% of the stuff that people buy in 1 year is trash. So, you know, how people around us spend is one thing. How we spend can be, do I really need it? And if I don't really need it, you don't purchase it. Then another is this, you know, that which is going to directly benefit the soul. Now, for practical things like eating and clothing and harsh winters and hot summers and so on, For the well-being of the soul, the body has to be maintained. Prabhupada's teachings make this very clear. The body has to be maintained fit so we can do service. So health needs are needed and food needs are needed and rest is needed. But, because it's needed for the soul to serve the Supreme, the answer is yes, I can certainly spend this money. And if the answer is it's not in that category, or something that's a more simple version, then Let me do that. More simple version. When I'm getting it, I can go down some further lists, but I'm just describe the principle. The principle of sense control for a transcendentalist is this for the service of Krishna? I'll share one little item with you because it came to my attention, reminded of it just today. Again, when I was in St. Louis, I was visiting a family's home. Some of you have children. So this family, they had one daughter. And the daughter is an amazing little girl. She's 8 or 9 years old. You know, but one of these, she's always lit up. She's a very bright young girl. And she's always talking. She always has some nice question to ask and something to share, and she's just like a bubbly, happy girl. And she was sharing with me how she was decorating her deity and the latest book that she read, and you know, so many things that she's doing in devotional service. And then her mother was describing, of late, my daughter is spending less time chanting and she's spending more time watching cartoons. And the girl, you know, she was embarrassed. But it's, you know, parents that have kids know what that's about, watching cartoons. And so then the mother says, so we took the television out. And she held her head up, she looked again. Said, but then for her schoolwork, we got her an internet which goes into her room, and now she's watching cartoons on the internet. So this is for a 7, 8-year-old. I spent some time with the family describing what's the difference between sense control because mommy and daddy don't like it and sense control because you want to please Krishna. And the conclusion of the discussion was she was very clear. Saying no, because it's not just because it, mommy and daddy won't be happy with me, but it's really a time waster and it's going to block my attraction and my relationship for Krishna. And she values her relationship with Krishna. As to her parents, she also has that quality. She's not just, you know, she's a very special kid. A lot of devotees' children are special children also. It's a training. Here's a message of training that Prabhupada, I probably heard it 150 times without exaggeration, how a child should be trained. He gave the example of the Gurukul, where a young boy at 5 years of age was placed in the ashram of the Brahmana teacher. And the Brahmana teacher trained the boys in all their academic teachings and spiritual teachings, but he also trained them in character. And the way that they were trained was they would perform some very simple, austere service for the teacher. They would go door to door and collect alms. Madhukari, because for my teacher, can you give something? And Prabhupada would say, any household lady, a little boy comes to the door and says, may I have something for my teacher? She's going to give him something. A pious lady will give him something. And whatever he has at the end of some little time, he brings that back to the ashram. He gives it to his teacher. And it's the training, it's the property of the teacher. The teacher then gives to his wife. The wife prepares a meal. She offers to the deity and she calls all the boys collectively, come and take your meal. And the training is, if the teacher doesn't call them to come and take their meal, they fast. Because it's the property of the teacher. The training is not because I did the work, it's mine. I'm entitled to have my meal because I went out and gathered these things. The training is the property of the teacher. So the teacher, being a compassionate person, doesn't forget to call the student. But if it were to happen, it then becomes the property of the teacher, and he says he just fasts. Prabhupada used the word he starves. It means he doesn't eat. Then what happens when the child grows up? Now he's got his education, and he's got a job, and he's earning something. And who does everything belong to? The person who trained him to do that and gave him the ability to do that. It belongs to God. And so everything is meant for God's service by that training of character. And if that training isn't there, then what's going to happen in adulthood? It's a life of sense gratification ramped up. And how do you correct that once it's already moving? Like this, the train is moving at so many miles an hour and there's a wall or there's a... How do you change people's lifestyles? So the training of the children is very important, but the training of the children isn't going to be possible if the example isn't there by the parents. Not going to happen. If we're concerned about... I'm not a father, but I'm deeply concerned about the children of devotees and the children of those children and what's going to be their situation and what are we doing now for their situation. That's something that all parents very quickly resonate with. But then, you know, so now you have your jobs and the economy is very shaky. And that gives some anxiety. And then not only some anxiety, but one of the fellows standing next to you, one of your dear friend devotees, loses his job. And what can we do to help that family that just lost their job? What are they going to do? What are we going to do to help them? So that's like a community is meant to take care of one another, just like brothers and sisters and immediate family take care of one another. Community is a more extended picture of the same thing, and we're meant to somehow assist one another. Some of the time that I've been spending here is describing, it's not just, you know, the immediate picture. There's the bigger picture. The bigger picture is, it's an epidemic. It's a much bigger looming problem that thought needs to go into today. Simplify, teach others by precept and also by example how to live a God-centered life, where life, the simplicity is one of the qualities of goodness. As much as you can, keep your life style simple. Keep the things that are around you minimal. If you need them, fine. If you don't need them, do without them. And spend more time, more of the vital human energy, in the matter of cultivation of spiritual consciousness. So, Padmanabha said he's going to lead off the question-answer session with some of the questions you all are asking him regularly.
Should I ask?
Yeah, sure.
Maharaj, in the presentation, you saw Dr. Smalley's slogan saying, be a scientist, save the world.
Yeah.
Like Prabhupada's slogan would be, be a devotee, save the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of devotees who come here, and I speak with them time to time, and one of the concerns they share is, they're trying to chant, they're trying to become a devotee, but on the other hand, they're constantly bombarded by the economic problems, the social problems, being with their family, with their wife, with their children, with their parents, with their friends, and problems at work, and so many different things going on. And when everything is fine and nice, there's Krishna consciousness is nice and blooming, but as soon as a slap of social problem or some other problem comes, Krishna consciousness goes on the back burner. And with the way things are progressing nowadays, Maharaj, these things will keep on coming at a faster rate at us.
Oh, yeah.
So all the devotees are facing a challenge saying, you know, I feel guilty when the Krishna consciousness is on the back burner. There's no way I can maintain it. So, you know, what can they do, any practical application in their
life? Sure. A big factor is faith, or the stage of advancement of one's Krishna consciousness, which is another way of saying evolved condition of faith. Prabhupada writes in very simple language in Sri Ashopanishad that the Lord has one energy which manifests differently according to our regard for Him. That one energy acts for those who are averse to Him by keeping them so busy they have no time. And people will tell us, isn't it? We've all had this experience. You invite someone to come to some function or to attend a Gita class or some, you know, a chant in their daily activity, and they say, I have no time. The material energy works in such a way that for those that their regard for Krishna on the real and genuine platform is tenuous, Krishna's energy works in such a way they have so much to do, they don't have time. The same soul, on the other hand, that has this faith in Krishna and regard for Krishna, the Supreme Personality Godhead, and takes shelter, that same energy works in a different way. It makes things such that their requirements of life can be taken care of with less of a struggle, and there's more opportunity to directly connect with the Personality of God. It is that's the internal potency versus the external potency. So which of these two potencies, although it's one potency, which of them are we going to experience? It has to do with yayatam mam papadyante tangs tataiva bhajamyaham bhajami aham. As they worship Krishna, as we worship Krishna and prapadyante, offer our surrender unto Krishna, Krishna gives us His protection. Or, if we choose, we're outside of Krishna's protection. We're therefore under the care of His external energy. And when we're under the care of the external energy, it's a fact. We don't have time. At least we perceive it like that. It certainly seems like it. So then, you know, to such persons, I would say, I know individuals like yourself that have job, family, home, and the whole package, and they're able to maintain. What makes the difference between they're able to maintain? Their faith is more mature. So progress as you can, but please see that from that spiritual well-being, material well-being follows, like a shadow follows the object that casts the shadow. See it the other way. From an absence of spiritual well-being, more and more there's material disturbances that cause your attention to go there and neglect or forget Krishna, put Krishna on the back burner. So if someone, let's say the individuals you're speaking to, they're certainly sincere. We'll make that assumption. They're very sincere souls. Otherwise, they wouldn't even say, oh, I feel bad that Krishna's on the back burner. They're sincere. But their advancement in Krishna consciousness has not grown, or their faith has not grown to the position where they put that spiritual component in their life first and foremost with the faith that material well-being will follow. It's not a matter of being negligent in my material affairs. It's a matter of faith. And as faith matures, it's attachment. You know, my thinking is just the opposite way around from the person that says, I can't. My thinking is, I can't imagine how people make their finish their day or go through life without core sadhana in their life. It's such a protection.
It's such a safeguard. It's such a energizer. I'll give another example of this. There, over the period of, I've been doing this for Krishna consciousness for a number of years now, something like 40 years. And one of the things that I've done is monitor, you know, get sadhana reports. The people that closely monitor their sadhana have 100%, not most of the time, 100% have had the realization, not because they were told, then repeated it. The realization is, those, even from day to day, when their sadhana is done nicely, the day goes nicely. When their sadhana is done poorly, the day is simply rocks in their shoes and bumps in the road. It's problematic. The whole day is like that. And then it goes for periods of time. Without spiritual well-being, even for day by day, it's problematic. So if I just look at the, it's like trying to adjust the shadow without addressing the object that's casting the shadow. Attend to the object that's casting the shadow, and automatically you can take care of the shadow. It's how life works, because that's what life is, the soul animating matter. If we attend to the needs of the soul, it's not neglect the other dimensions of needs, but that's the essential need, the well-being of the soul. And that's a matter of faith. So as faith is not yet mature, there are those moments when faith gets tested by circumstance. And one can only act according to their capacity of faith. We can't fault that person, oh, you're bad. It's not a matter of good, bad. It's a matter of, that's the stage of faith. So then, what you can do, and I can do, and we can do with such a person is help nurture their faith. Help them be honest with their level of faith, but also nurture their faith. And in course of time, that nurtured faith will come to the point where it's not neglect the worldly things, but the strength to properly address the worldly things will come from the spiritual well-being. The Krishna factor makes all the difference in facing with conviction. I know families, very wonderful devotee families, that are presently, the husband is unemployed. They're taking it as, this is an opportunity, it's not party time, it's let me hit the reset button and let me carefully consider what are the values in my life. They're fully confident Krishna will protect them, take care of them. They're thinking, how now, you know, I was doing things in a certain way, kind of just on a treadmill, just doing them. Now I have a break. I'll take this break to reevaluate how I want to do things and what I want to do and how I want to spend my time. And Krishna takes care of his devotees. That's faith. Prabhupada tells a story when he was a householder, and there was the British had artificially created a famine or a scarcity of rice. They held back the rice supply. So the price of rice doubled. And Prabhupada described in detail how they did it. And poor people starved. They literally died of starvation. But, you know, whoever was holding the rice got a lot of money. Prabhupada wasn't very happy with that. Wealthy people had to pay double, and poor people didn't have double, so they starved. So Prabhupada was very concerned with the devotees at the temple. So he went to the devotees at the temple and said, are you okay? There's this famine. Their reply was, no, Krishna's taking care of it. We're feeding many people. We're taking care of it. And Prabhupada said, from that I could understand, Krishna takes care of those who depend upon him. And it's true. If one thinks otherwise, it's a lack of faith. It doesn't mean be irresponsible. It doesn't mean that. Be responsible, but there should be responsible with full faith in Krishna. Ultimately, I'm relying upon Krishna, not, the state of the economy, as the world knows it today. I'm relying upon Krishna. And Krishna protects. If, that family man is concerned about protecting his child, what to speak of God? Who's taking care of those who are dependent upon him, his loving devotees. Surely he'll... So that's a fact. It's a fact that one knows as much as one knows anything in life. So our role in dealing with those kinds of circumstances is to help nurture faith. We also can do some practical things to help people in times of need as servants of the Lord. Helping other servants of the Lord.
For our study, this is the last question.
Okay.
Somebody else can ask.
Okay.
The one aspect is economic and monetary. Another aspect which we have found is a family. Husband tries to become a devotee, wife doesn't like to be. Wife tries to become a devotee, husband doesn't like, or their parents don't like to be, or their friends don't like to be. And there is social pressure. And that coupled with the economic pressure now, the devotee thinks the easy way out for peace at home is just not worry about chanting my rounds, or not doing this or that, and compromise on Krishna consciousness. How do we deal with that?
That's more challenging. Because within oneself is one thing, interpersonal is another thing. So with interpersonal matters, again, it very much depends upon faith and also support of that faith. But I've seen exceptions, but largely the rule is, if one is not projecting expectations upon one's spouse, but is internally very Krishna conscious and acting in ways that a good husband or a good wife would act in relation to their good wife or good husband, their good spouse, and consistent in commitment to the relationship, that is, many cases, not all cases, many cases, the concern is, will this take my husband or wife away from me? Because they're becoming so much devoted to Krishna, it's like Krishna's competition. The wife may think like that, or the husband may think like that. In some cases, it's just like their heart has become hard from something, some disappointment in the past, and so they don't want to go there with devotion. But if the relationship can be a very strong relationship, and the devotion maintained internally, then the spouse or family member or parents or something. Especially with parents, if parents can see the practical lives of how devotees live, the Sangha of devotees live together, if they can, largely this is Indian family, so if they leave India and come and stay in your home and see how the devotee community works, how the children, job, they're very, not only they're very nice, they're very normal. Someone was sharing this with me just this morning before I got on the train to come here to Harrisburg. He's from Tamil Nadu, and his mother is appreciating Krishna consciousness like anything. Whereas when he first started, she was very concerned. But she saw that the things that were his bad qualities and bad habits are now just gone. And how did that happen? When she tried her whole life to help, you know, improve her son, just there's certain areas, many things were fine, some areas were not. And now they're, so by qualities, not by message, if we exhibit the qualities of a Vaishnav, it's compelling. Whether it's a parent or a spouse, if we are genuinely exhibiting the qualities that a Vaishnava has, it's attractive. You can do whatever you want if you have those nice qualities, that kind of thing. The problems come when one tries to push the other party and they push back. They feel uncomfortable. So far better to attract than to push. Attract by qualities, not by giving them the sauce. You know, you shouldn't do this. Why are you doing that? By Vaishnava qualities. Anything else? Yes? What's the one?
What does the consumption of crude oil have to do with religion?
Have to do with?
Religion.
Why am I presenting this to all of you? That's what you're asking? Is that your question?
It's trying to bridge, you know, for example, of the crude oil to Krishna consciousness.
I am too. The message of Krishna consciousness is, I express the verse from Bhagavad Gita, Vishaya Vinivartante Niraharsha Dehinam, Raso Varjam Raso Pyasyat Param Drishva Navartate. The materialistic demeanor says, I want to enjoy. And that's why we're in this material world. Very strong desires to enjoy independently of Krishna. One of the instruments that has really helped people ramp up like anything their capacity to enjoy in this human form of life is the supply of oil. It's produced a world that is built upon oil. Like that little video clip said, I don't care whether people say they worship Allah, Buddha, Jesus, or whoever. They worship petroleum. You know, the way that the lifestyle of people in the world today is a lifestyle of sense gratification, which is energized by oil production and consumption. And when that sense gratification gets pinched, people panic. There's wars over it, and there's great grief over it, and so on. My message is not just let's find another type of energy besides petroleum. Let us turn our attention to what is the real platform of satisfaction. The real platform of satisfaction is awakening our dormant loving relationship with God. If we awaken our dormant loving relationship with God, whether we have oil or no oil, we have whatever it is that we have, we can be satisfied with because we're happy within our relationship with God. Let's go the other direction, up 180 degrees the other direction. Having forgotten our relationship with God, the world has become mad after sense gratification. And that instrument, now I'll say it again, the instrument for sense gratification is about to disappear. And people will go mad in the absence of sense gratification. When, as concerned devotees of the Lord, we should be aware of what that freak-out factor that a lot of people are undergoing and will continue to undergo and become calamitous. What's the reason and what's the solution? Just about 1 hour from here is one of the solutions. It's called Gita Nagari, where Srila Prabhupada, understanding not just the shortage of oil, but he spoke about it because it was going on even during the Nixon administration. Big, big thing about oil. Prabhupada wanted to establish a God-conscious lifestyle based upon simple living and high thinking. And if y'all here can appreciate that message that Srila Prabhupada gave, then the calamity that the world is facing due to the increased prices of oil, and with the increased prices of oil, the increased prices of food, and the increased prices of all kinds of products that we think is going to bring us happiness, if we can withdraw our concern from that and go to the instruction that Srila Prabhupada gave us of simple living and high thinking, we can save ourselves a lot of grief. There's one response to, you know, what is the relationship with oil and God consciousness? There's spiritual solutions to material problems, is another simple way of saying it. And if we don't turn to spiritual solutions to material problems, we'll find ourselves endlessly struggling with problems. And whatever solutions there are to those material problems, material solutions create more material problems. We need spiritual solutions. And the spiritual solution is the lifestyle of Vedic culture. Most of us are not prepared for that. We want high standard of living and God consciousness. And there's nothing wrong if we understand how to use that in the proper way to bring people to God consciousness. And if that's not what our thought is, it's just karma mishra bhakti, we're not going to be satisfied. Anything else? Questions, comments? Yes? The children's voices went up. When some people have, some people don't have. Now what was your question? When we don't have anything, how do we increase our faith?
That I understood. But there are people who have all the comforts, so should we just let
But when they do have comforts, how should they increase their Krishna consciousness? That's your question? In one sense, having comforts is a blessing from Krishna. In another sense, having comforts is not. The opposite of whatever a blessing is. It can be a problem. It can be a problem if our happiness is defined by having. Because then that one, it covers our consciousness from appreciating what real happiness is. And when that having of material comforts is taken away, we become terribly distressed. Both are unwanted. So that's what not to do. What to do is, one of the things I mentioned is simplify. Accept only those things that are really necessary. Although you may have access to comforts, don't avail yourself to that beyond what's necessary. And see how that which you do have can be utilized in service to others. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us so many wonderful ways by which we can serve the Krishna consciousness, awaken the Krishna consciousness of others. Through bringing resources of material well-being to bear upon the lives of others. For example, we have computer technology. So it can be used in such a way that it can bring Krishna consciousness into the lives of others. And developing the skills of how to use it and how to apply it. It's very nice. Very nice utilization of a comfortable life. Or having things whereas other people don't have those things. The key is our own internal consciousness and the application of that which we have in service to others. Serve the needs of the souls of others with whatever facilities are provided for you. And then it's not attachment to them in the mood of enjoying them. It's in the mood of Krishna is very kind, here's some facility, let me see how I can use this in Krishna's service. It's serving his part and parcel living entities. And when that consciousness is there, there's always ways to do that. Always. If we can't think of what those ways are, ask those that are good at it, and they'll give you some indicators. Here in this Harrisburg community, if you have some resource, you're not sure how to use it in Krishna's service, go to Padmanabh and he'll help you understand how you can use that resource in Krishna's service. Intelligence, ability, strength, wealth, health, vitality. Use those resources in Krishna's service. Yes?
I'm basically, we are from the smart sampradaya, where we believe Shiva and Vishnu.
Okay.
So there are actually two things that are going in my mind right now. One is the karma, I go to my office, take care of my wife and kids. And whatever I do, this is for you, God. I did this work for you. I want to understand the perspective of Krishna consciousness as for the people who believe in Shiva as well as Lord Vishnu. And also, I want to understand the karma perspective of, you know, of God realization. Like, one way is like, you know, chanting is one way of doing it. Is there any other way? Look, submitting my work, like that work, I do it for God and say, this is what for you that I've done it, like, you know, or this is for maybe, I don't know how to put it, but that's what is going through my mind right now.
Okay. I could tell that you wanted to ask a question, but I didn't know what the question was.
See, the problem with me, I'm not able to put it, but like, in perspective, is like, where does Shiva and Vishnu stand?
Okay, well, the point that you, the first point, is not a Vishnu versus Shiva kind of a consideration. It's a Karma Yoga question. Karma Yoga says, karma nivarikaraste ma paleshu kadachana. You know that sloka, right? From Bhagavad Gita? So, you're entitled to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the pala of that prescribed duty. Now, what do you do with that pala of the prescribed duty? You offer it to the Supreme. So, someone may be worshipper of Shiva, someone may be worshipper of Vishnu, and to them, Shiva is Supreme or the other Vishnu is Supreme. They're offering to the Supreme, as far as they know. It just so happens that what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, those that are offering unto the various devatas, is offered without, it's avidhi purvakam. It's done without a proper understanding of the relationship of that representative of the Supreme and the Supreme, or the devata and the paramadevata, or the nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam yo vididati kaman. There's one who is supplying the necessities of the many. Eko bahunam yo vididati kaman. He's supplying the necessities of all. So, the position of Karma Yoga is detached work, saying, let me do this for you. Or another verse from Bhagavad Gita, yad karoshi, yad asnasi, yad jahosi, tadasi, yad tapas yasi kaunteya, tat purasha madarpanam. It's Karma Yoga. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, give away, what sacrifice, what austerity, do that as a offering unto me, which is what you described. That's Karma Yoga. The distinction between Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga is that in the realm of Bhakti Yoga, this is chapter 12 Bhagavad Gita, in the realm of Bhakti Yoga, I've accepted that, or at least in principle I accept that my very existence is a part and parcel of the Supreme. Mami Vamsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Eternally, that's who I am. I'm part of the Supreme. So what does the part do in relation to the whole? One serves the Supreme. So under that conception, I follow some vidhis of sadhana bhakti. I follow the rules and regulations of Bhakti Yoga, what Krishna says in 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. By so doing, one develops a desire to attain to Him, not just to be detached from the work and take care of my family, but without attachment to the fruits of my work, but attachment to the Supreme. Because my wife and my children, they're also parts of the Supreme, as am I. And I follow the vidhis of sadhana bhakti, so that I'll attain the Supreme, and so will they. It's a different purpose than detached work. So, say it differently, with different language. With this, if I'm acting as a fully devoted soul to the Supreme, automatically the fruits of my work go to the Supreme.
If I'm not in that consciousness, then I want to do something that will be an act of sacrifice to the Supreme. But that's a subset. That's already included within a life of devotion to the Supreme. So your second question is related to this. Your second question is, chanting is one way. Are there other ways? Well, chanting, that there are 9 processes of bhakti, but they all flow from hearing in Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu. So in this, it's my cell phone. In this age of Kali, the chanting of the holy name is the principal means, initial means, principal means of awakening our God consciousness. It's something like, not the same, but a visual image for me is when you're pulling a tissue out of a tissue box. You don't have to grab the whole tissue. Just grab a corner of the tissue and you start pulling. The whole tissue comes out. So the chanting of the holy name is a means of connecting with our relationship with God, with whatever conception we may have grown up with. I grew up with one, you grew up with another, he grew up with another one. It's connecting with a relationship with God just through chanting of the holy name, regardless of the conception that we had growing up. It's a soul to the Supreme connection through his holy name. It's universal. And that brings the holistic, you know, the total being of, in course of time, all of our body, mind, and words, activities become dedicated to the Supreme. Fully from this one activity. And the authority for that one activity is the scripture. And the faith also comes, is nurtured by scripture and practical experience. Through the pure chanting of God's holy name. Harir Nama, Harir Nama, Harir Nama, Eva Kevalam, Kolo Nastyeva, 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 Gatir, Anyata. And so forth. So many in scriptures of the world, so many points of emphasis there are in calling upon God's holy name. So your question is, are there other means? Other means augmented with that are very nice. Minus that, in this age of Kali, nastyeva, nastyeva, nastyeva. So I'm not going to contradict what scripture says. It's to be connected with other things. Other things connected, fine. The means of purification is so simple. And in this age of Kali, we need something that's very simple. Otherwise, people aren't going to do it. And even if it's simple, people aren't going to do it. It must be, it is simple. And it's universal. Doesn't matter the conception of life. Doesn't matter the culture. Doesn't matter the language. Doesn't matter the color of the skin. Doesn't matter your gender. Doesn't matter your socioeconomic position. Doesn't matter your birth. Your qualification is your spirit soul. That's eternally connected to the Supreme. That sound vibration makes that connection. With faith, one who takes that up will experience that connection. And then one can continue making the next step, and purify one's life completely, body, mind, and words completely. But starting with the soul connection with the Supreme. And not only hear the scriptures, but understand the scriptures and apply the scriptures. I met an atheist at Illinois Institute of Technology. He said he reads Bhagavad Gita every day. He came up after the presentation and said, "This is the first time I've come. I'm an atheist." I said, "Okay. Can you describe, you know, tell me a little bit about it?" He wanted to share with me how he was an atheist. And he wanted to know you know, so many things, so many, but he reads Bhagavad Gita, but he's not understanding it. Huh?
Why did he understand?
Well, two reasons. In order to understand, one has to have, one's heart has to become purified. Therefore, chanting is a means of purification. Second is, I asked him, whose translation are you reading? He said, you know, I tried to find out and it doesn't say anywhere. I said, you know what that means? It's probably a group of scholars that got together and made a translation of Bhagavad Gita. And I read Bhagavad Gita. I read seven versions of Bhagavad Gita before I, when I was in college, before, like you, before, you know, this, speaking to a college student, before I read Bhagavad Gita as it is. When I was reading the other versions, I couldn't understand them at all. And when I read, just started reading Bhagavad Gita, it was very clear. It was so clear. I said, whoa, why is this one clear and the other ones aren't? I'm still the same person. Because the translation is coming into cyclic succession from one who is pure in devotion. It's very clear. It's very clear. A little anecdote. 2 years ago at our GBC meeting, I'll make it real quick. There's this forum where devotees share stories about book distribution. So there's one Russian girl who had a book table in front of Krishna Balaram Temple in Vrindavan. Have you been to our temple in Vrindavan? Can you picture it in your mind? No. It gets like, you know, a zillion people every day coming and going and coming and going. So she, you know, very fair complexion girl at a book table. People coming in for the Didi Darshan Krishna Balaram Temple. One yogi came, long, matted hair, dragging on the ground, you know, 50 followers coming with him, going in to take darshan of Sri Sri Radha Shamasundar and Krishna Balaram. And they all went in with him and he darshan of the deities and he came back out and he stopped at the book table. He looked at Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. He asked her how much and had one of his followers buy the Bhagavad Gita. Next day he came back alone. He came right to the table and said, I've been teaching Bhagavad Gita for 40 years. And when I read this Bhagavad Gita, for the first time I understood Bhagavad Gita. I read it all night long. And I wanted to share this with you. He spoke English because she didn't speak any Hindi or anything. And he bought some other books of Srila Prabhupada. Now, it's not many people that are going to say like that. For 40 years, I've been teaching Bhagavad Gita, and I never understood it. I didn't understand it until I read this Bhagavad Gita. But when it's very clearly presented, then it's understandable. And everyone's heart is pure. And, you know, at least something can come in. So the chanting is to cleanse the heart, cheta darpana marjanam. And combined with that cleansing of the heart is the scriptural guidance coming into cyclic succession. Combine these two things, we can progress nicely.
But if you go and talk to an atheist, you would say, like, I want to first understand it and then believe it.
Well, it doesn't work that way. But you know, the atheist, the fellow that I was speaking with, it was, you know, I asked him, why are you an atheist? What confidence do you have that says, I'm an atheist? So he said, because those who are theists are against evolution. And I know that there's some truth in evolution. So we had some little discussion on evolution. I said, microevolution for sure is a fact. But, you know, that life comes from matter is not a fact. And, you know, it's because I have some experience with this, I said, you know, Darwin, his origin of the species was about changing of the shapes of species, but the assumption where did the species come from to begin with, or where did life come to begin with, is not origin of the species. He's speaking of microevolution. largely. And there's this assumption that says life comes from chemicals. It's just a very brief section of that book. Now, that part we strongly disagree with, that life comes from life, not from chemicals. He said, I never heard that explanation before. It's okay. Now stick around a bit longer. But, you know, read two things. So I checked later, and he's done those two things, and he's feeling differently than he felt before. He's done some chanting, and he's read Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is. His roommate is a devotee. But now, this thing about relationships, his roommate didn't push it. Just when it came up in conversation, then his roommate said, hey, you know, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to a Hare Krishna program. Why are you going to a Hare Krishna program? You should be an atheist. And they had the two-hour conversation about... So he said, okay, I thought, I'll come. I'll come to the program. And then this dialogue. So if you don't push people, you know, what's especially important in helping people that in this age of Kali are largely misguided, and it's not to blame because there's lots of people misguiding people all over the place. So it's what's more compelling is your qualities than your message. You should have a clear message. You should live your clear message. You should be a good representative of that message. But very strongly one should be compassionate. Not just, oh, you're an atheist, get out of here. That's I think that what he was, my sense is when he spoke like that, that's what he was testing me to see how I was going to respond to his coming right in my face and saying, I'm an atheist. And I didn't react. And he was surprised. I didn't argue with him. I didn't, you know, didn't put him down. I didn't get into a fight with him.
I agree with that. Like, you know, these days people are on the post about being an atheist. You know, I don't want to take some different names, but Richard Dawkins is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
They do post about being, you know, an atheist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without any, you know, substantial, like, when you question them a few, they go back, you know, they don't have answers.
That's right. That's right. So, a bystander, when they're observing a discussion like that, they see the qualities of the Vaishnav, the reasonableness of the Vaishnav, the confidence and compelling arguments of the Vaishnav. So what's more important is the qualities of the Vaishnav than anything. Chanting.
Chanting and the Bhagavad Gita. But you also said about the Navratam,
and remember it. They flow. It all.
So these are the other also means that one can.
Sure. But before you start picking flowers and pulling, you know, taking the fruits off the tree, nurture the tree. When I was a small boy, my father liked gardening, and he planted a peach tree in the backyard. I remember as a small boy looking at the peach tree, saying, Daddy, when's it going to produce peaches? And they laughed and said, be patient. So the other processes flow from hearing and chanting. In course of time, it produced wonderful peaches, but, you know, there was a lot of watering. And the chanting, hearing and chanting, shravanam kirtanam, is like watering. There's the seed, and you water the seed. Bhakti lata bija. The seed of the creeper of devotion is watered by hearing and chanting. So by hearing and chanting comes Vishnu smaranam. From Vishnu smaranam comes Pada sevanam. And archanam, and Bandhanam and Sakyam and Dasyam and Atmanivedanam. Then you get the full fruit and flowers, everything. But it starts from the seed being carefully watered by hearing and chanting. Someone else has something? Okay. We're finished? Pujari is eager to do the RTM. We're okay? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Krishna, I had made request to Maharaj that
don't say it.
If we could increase this visit by at least 50% to Harrisburg, I would like you all to lobby on my behalf. Thank you very much, Maharaj. We'll have Aarti.